Subi.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Welcome. We can start then. Yeah. We had this rather childish interlude for hen clucking, and then we go on with a conversation where we were before. Anyhow, says Joe, and that's continuing the discussion before the interpolation. Good.
Anyhow, says Joe. Field and Annette are going over tonight to London to ask about it on the floor of the House of Commons. Are you sure? Says Bloom. The councillor's going. I wanted to see him as it happens. Well, he's going off by the mailboat, says Joe, tonight. That's too bad, says Bloom. I wanted particularly, perhaps only Mr. Field is going. I couldn't phone. No. You're sure? Nana's going too, says Joe. The league told him to ask a question tomorrow about the Commissioner of Police forbidding Irish games in the park. What do you think of that, citizen? The slough and the heron.
Good. They're talking that two Irish members of parliament in London, Field and Nannetti, and Bloom wants to see Nannetti because of that ad, the advertisement that's not yet in the back. So he would like to speak to him. Now he's gone to London by mailboat. Anyhow, Field and Nannetti are going over tonight to ask about on the floor of the House of Commons. Are you sure? The councillor is going. I wanted to see him as it happens. Well, he's going off by the mailboat, says Joe. There were two mailboats, one in the morning that we saw in the first chapter and one in the evening. That's too bad, says Bloom. I wanted particularly. Perhaps only Mr. Field is going. I couldn't phone. No. You're sure? Nannan is a kind of Irish, Hibernicized version of Nannetti, because he's already a political figure. Going to, said Joe, the league told him to ask a question tomorrow about the commissioners of police forbidding Irish games in the park. The Phoenix Park is a big park, and they were allowed to play polo at the English games, but not the Irish hurley and things like that. A political issue. What do you think of that, citizen? The slough and Éireann, that is the Irish army, they gave the organisation a kind of military title. And what comes now is the minutes, the kind of protocol, what's written down of a sitting in Parliament, the kind of thing that the newspapers would report, because everything was recorded, and that's now the next interlude. Imagine they're in Westminster in Parliament.
Mr. Coe, Conacre, Multifarnham, Nat. Arising out of the question of my honourable friend, the member for Shillelagh, may I ask the right honourable gentleman whether the government had issued orders that these animals shall be slaughtered, though no medical evidence is forthcoming as to the pathological condition. Mr. Allforce, Tam O'Shanter, Con.
Honourable members are already in possession of the evidence produced before a committee of the whole House. I feel I cannot usefully add anything to that. The answer to the honourable member's question is in the affirmative.
Mr. O'Reilly, Montanotti, Nat. Have similar orders been issued for the slaughter of human animals who dare to play Irish games in the Phoenix Park?
Mr. Allforce. The answer is in the negative.
Mr. Co-Conacher, has the right honourable gentleman's famous Bishopstown telegram inspired the policy of gentlemen on the Treasury bench?
Oh, Mr. Allforce, I must have notice of that question. Mr. Staleywit, Buncombe, in. Don't hesitate to shoot. Ironical opposition cheers. The Speaker. Order! Order! The House rises. Cheers.
Yeah. So, the parliamentary proceedings. And it has a kind of form. Mr. Cow Conacre. Cow, we understand, it's about the foot and mouth disease. Conacre, I think, means 1 acre. There was some kind of political movement that each person should have 1 acre. So it's a political issue behind. For multi-farmen, NAT, that's nationalists, the Irish nationalists. And you see that particular way the parliamentarians speak. It's not the most direct way. Arising out of the question of my honourable friend, and as you also know, your opponent and everybody, you name you my honourable friend. So it's not a friend, it doesn't have to be honourable, but that's the rule. The member for Shillela, that Shillela is a place, in her, but Shillela is also what these cudgel, they're cut from oak trees, what they are where they can beat each other on the head, Shillela. May I ask the right honourable gentleman whether the government has issued orders that these animals shall be slaughtered for the mouth, though no medical evidence is forthcoming as to their pathological condition. That is to speak the speech of Parliament. Mr. Allforce, Tomashan, Con, that's conservative, so Tomashan is somewhere in Scotland, Mr. Allforce. Of course, its animals are on all fours, but the English Prime Minister was Mr. Balfour. So, take that in. Honourable members are already in possession of the evidence produced before a committee of the whole House. I feel I cannot usefully add anything to that. The answer to the honourable member's question is in the affirmative. That's a quick way of saying it. Then Mr. O'Reilly, now there's an Irish word, O'Reilly, but O'Reilly, I'm quite sure, is a name that Joyce must have seen in Zurich, because there are O'Reillys coming from Ticino, Italy, I don't quite know. It's a name right around the corner, so, but I don't know what the relation to Switzerland is. Montenotte, nationalists. So they always say which constituency they represent and their party national. Have similar orders been issued for the slaughter of human animals who dare to play Irish games in the Phoenix Park? It's a kind of ironic exaggeration. Mr. Allfour, the answer is in the negative. Mr. Carol Conacre, has right honourable gentleman, famous Michelson telegram inspired the policy of the gentleman of the Treasury Bank. Oh, there was a Michelson telegram in Irish history. I don't quite know at the moment what it is, but it doesn't matter too much. Oh, is usually the recording of the noise in the, when they laugh or says, Mr. Allforce, I must have notice of that question. Mr. Staleywit, that's obviously not an honour. Staleywit, Buncombe, independent. Buncombe, as we know, is also nonsense. Don't hesitate to shoot. That is something attributed to one of the Irish secretaries against the populace. Don't hesitate to shoot. That is, of course, the Irish question and the submission and the colonialisation. Ironical opposition cheers. Then the Speaker, order, we've heard that, Lord, and the House rises, cheers. So that is the parody of the meeting in London.
There's the man, says Joe, that made the Gaelic sports revival. There he is, sitting there, the man that got away James Stevens, the champion of all Ireland, at putting a 16-pound shot. What was your best throw, citizen? No, Bocklesh, says the citizen, letting on to be modest. There was a time I was as good as the next fella anyhow. Put it there, citizen, says Joe. You were, and a bloody sight better. Is that really a fact, says Alf? Yes, says Boone. That's well known. You not know that? So off they started with Irish sport and Shawnee games, the like of the lawn tennis,
about Hurley and putting the stone and Missy the soil and building up a nation once again and all that. And of course, Bloom had to have his say too about if a fella had a rower's heart, violent exercise was bad. I declare to me, Auntie Macassar, if you took up a straw from the bloody floor, and if you said to Bloom, look at Bloom, do you see that straw? That's a straw. Declare to me, Aunt, he'd talk about it for an hour, so he would, and talk steady.
No. So, there's the man, Joe, that made the Gaelic sports revival. Now, the Citizen is based on an Irish figure, Michael McCusick, who was really starting an Irish sports, the Gaelic Athletic Association. And you know, the 19th century was full of sports movements as preparation for the military service. You had them everywhere. And that's where all these Turnverein and things started. It was always connected with national issues. There he is sitting there. The man that got away, James Stevens, that was a famous escape, James Stevens from a prison, and nobody knows who got him away. So he got away, that's most likely only a rumour. The champion of all, Ireland, are putting the 16-pound shot. That's probably a kind of, what you call it, throwing Google stores and that kind of thing. Shot put, I believe. And you realize, and I have to talk about it sometime, about the background, as you know, the Cyclops threw a rock at the ship of Odysseus. But that'll come at a certain time. The champion of all, I put you a 60-pound shot. What was the best throw, Citizen? Now, Buckley, Citizen, don't mention it. So they said, letting on to be modest. There was a time I was as good as the next fellow, as anyhow. Put it there, Citizen, said, so you were on the bloody sight better. Is that really a fact, says Alf? Yes, says Bloom. That's well known. Do you not know that? So off they started out Irish sport. As the Citizen, and this man, McCusick, called himself the Citizen. They started about Irish sport and the Shoneen game. Shoneen is a derivation of John, like John Bull, the Englishman. Shoneen are Irish people who have a liking for English things. Shoneen, it's a put down. Shoneen games, like the like of the lawn tennis. And of course, lawn tennis is very British, as you can see. And about Hurley, and Hurley is very Irish. And putting the stone. And ratio of the soil. Ratio of the soil means a sort of nationalist things, homely kind of sports law. And building up a nation once again. There's an Irish song, A Nation Once Again, that is now the anthem of Ireland, but it was just a patriotic song at the time. And all of that. And of course, Bloom had to have his say about if a fellow had a rower's heart, violent exercise was bad. Bloom often takes the opposite. It's a kind of argumentative. So too much violent exercise is no good. But of course, as I say, this kind of militarization through sport was a 19th century nationalist general occupation. You have it everywhere. You have it in Cadetten, you have it in Germany, and there. I declare to my Auntie Macassar, usually you declare to God, why to Auntie Macassar, I don't know, if you took up a straw from the bloody floor, and if you said to Bloom, look at Bloom, do you see that straw? There's a straw. Declare to me, Aunt. He'd talk about it for an hour, so he wouldn't talk steady. He's complaining that Bloom talks too much, and Bloom is, in fact, more talkative here than he normally is. A little bit incautious because there's not much use arguing with nationalists. But obviously, I say he may be a bit nervous because of thinking or not thinking of home. And now we have a parody of a meeting that's coming now. It takes almost 2 hours, two pages.
A most interesting discussion took place in the ancient hall of Brin Ó Cuanáin's in Sroidhbhreatain Ó Beag, under the auspices of Slua na hÉireann, on the revival of ancient Gaelic sports and the importance of physical culture as understood in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient Ireland for the development of the race. The venerable president of this noble order was in the chair, and the attendance was of large dimensions. After an instructive discourse by the chairman, a magnificent oration eloquently and forcibly expressed, a most interesting and instructive discussion of the usual high standard of excellence ensued as to the desirability of the revivability of the ancient games and sports of our ancient pan-Celtic forefathers. The well-known and highly respected worker in the cause of our old tongue, Mr. Joseph McCarthy Hines, made an eloquent appeal for the resuscitation of the ancient Gaelic sports and pastimes practiced morning and evening by Finn McCool, as calculated to revive the best traditions of manly strength and power handed down to us from ancient ages. L. Bloom, who met with a mixed reception of applause and hisses, having espoused the negative, the vocalist chairman brought the discussion to a close in response to repeated requests and hearty plaudits from all parts of a bunker house by a remarkably noteworthy rendering of the immortal Thomas Osborne Davis's evergreen verses, happily too familiar to need recalling here, A Nation Once Again, in the execution of which the veteran patriot champion may be said without fear of contradiction to have fairly excelled himself. The Irish Caruso Garibaldi was in superlative form, and his stentorian notes were heard to the greatest advantage in the time-honored anthem sung as only our citizen can sing it. His superb high-class vocalism, which by its super quality greatly enhanced its already international reputation, was vociferously applauded by the large audience, among which were to be noticed many prominent members of the clergy, as well as representatives of the press and the bar and other learned professions. The proceedings then terminated. Among the clergy present were the Very Reverend William Delaney, S.J., LL.D., the Right Reverend Gerald Malloy, D.D., the Reverend P.J. Kavanagh, C.S., S.P., the Reverend T. Waters, C.C., the Reverend John M. Ivers, P.P., the Reverend P.J. Cleary, O.S.F., the Reverend L.J. Hickey, O.P., the Very Reverend Father Nicholas, O.S.F.C., the Very Reverend B. Gorman, O.D.C., the Reverend T. Marr, S.J., the Very Reverend James Murphy, S.J., the Reverend John Lavery, V.F., the Very Reverend William Doherty, D.D., the Reverend Peter Fagan, O.M., the Reverend T. Brangan, O.S.A., the Reverend J. Flavin, C.C., the Reverend M.A. Hackett, C.C., the Reverend W. Hurley, C.C., the Right Reverend Monsignor McManus, B.G., the Reverend B.R. Slattery, O.M.I., the Very Reverend M.D. Scally, P.P., the Reverend F.T. Purcell, O.P., the Very Reverend Timothy Canon Gorman, P.P., the Reverend J. Flanagan, C.C. The laity
talking about...
Moment.
But violent exercises, Alf. Were you at the Kel Bennett?
Yep.
Stop.
Yeah. Good.
Sorry.
So you have a kind of meeting with the usual language that is, and everything is superlative. A most interesting discussion took place in the ancient hall of Brian O'Kernan's in Sweden. That is Barney Kiernan. That is how it's spelled in Irish. In Little Britain Street. So this is put in Irish because, of course, Irish language was just being reintroduced. Under the auspice of the Slua na hÉireann, that's a kind of old historical pseudo-patriotic army of the Irish. On the revival of ancient Gaelic sports and the importance of physical culture as understood in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient Ireland. And you know, all of these talks began, the Greeks and the Romans already had this, and then you go to the new time. The venerable president of this noble order was in the chair. Well, president in the chair, you realize that president is the one who is sitting in front of everybody. So he must be in the chair. All I want to say, it is slightly tautological. The president was in the chair and the attendant was of large dimension. After an instructive discourse by the chairman, a magnificent oration, eloquently and forcibly expressed, a most interesting and instructive discussion of the usual high standard of excellence ensued as to the desirability of the revivability, very elegantly expressed, of the ancient games and sport of our ancient pan-Celtic forefathers. Pan-Celtic, Irish, Scottish, everybody, everything that is Celtic. And you can see the parody in there. The well-known and highly respected worker in the course of our old tongue, Mr. Joseph McCarthy Hines, who had just come from a language meeting, as we know, made an eloquent appeal for the resuscitation of the ancient Gaelic sports and pastimes practiced morning and evening by Finn McCool, the mythological figure in Ireland, as calculated to revive to the best tradition of manly strength and power handed down to us from ancient ages. El Bloom, who met with a mixed reception of applause and hisses, having espoused the negative, as Bloom always says, but on the other hand, and you know, he has espoused the negative. Now, I think all of you, even if you read the book the first time, know that at the end of the book, Bloom's wife, Bloom's spouse, ends with a great deal of yes, 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 affirmative. So there's a slightly odd touch here. He espoused the negative. The vocalist chairman brought the discussion to a close. In response to repeated requests and hearty plaudits from all parts of a bumper house. When the theatre is full, it's called a bumper house. By a remarkably noteworthy rendering of the immortal Thomas Osborne Davies evergreen verses, happily too familiar to need a calling here, a nation once again, that was already mentioned, that is, I say now, the Irish anthem, in the execution of which the veteran patriot champion may be said, without fear of contradiction, to have fairly excelled himself. The Irish Caruso Garibaldi. Caruso, of course, was a great singer coming, and Garibaldi was the man who had, one of them, the most famous one, who had led the Italians to their own state, because the Italian state had to be put together. And that happened. Italy became a nation, or was already a nation, while Ireland was not. Well, in superlative form, and of course the Italians can sing, and the stentorian notes, stentor, you may know, was somebody in the Iliad who had a very, very loud voice, and you still have, say, a stentorian voice, which I'm sorry to say I do not have. Stentorian notes were heard to the greatest advantage in the time-honoured anthem sung as only a citizen can sing it. His superb high-class vocalism, which by its super quality greatly enhanced the already international reputation. In my edition, I don't have enhanced, I have enchanted. And I remember when I first read that, I thought that's one of Joyce's jokes. But Joyce actually wrote enhanced, so the C is really a misprint that got into it and takes away one potential from his already international reputation. What was vociferously applauded by the large audience, amongst which were to be noticed many prominent members of the clergy, as well as representatives of the press and the bar and the other learned professions. The proceedings then terminated. And in these reports, and they were quite common, there's usually afterwards a list of people of note, I don't know, who attended them. Amongst the clergy present were there, and then there's a whole list of clergymen, which I am not going to read out again. And I would guess, if you ever, and you might do worse than that, ever read the book again, that at this point you may unfairly skip a little bit, because it's a list, they're real clergymen. They're all really with their titles and all of this. And it seems to me this is a chapter full of catalogues. They usually have something funnier. And when William Tell is an Irish hero and things like that. But this list is merely a plain list without any, as far as I can see, joke. You can laugh about the Reverend, the Very Reverend, things like that, and all these letters, but they're all real. So it is, in a way, a list without any excitement about it. So it's just a list as such as they are. And I have an occasion when I had to present it, smuggle in a few other names, and nobody would notice, I don't think. But there's something with all these initials and things like that. So this is a kind of archetypal, normal, boring catalogue. All catalogues could be this boring. Fortunately, they're not. Now back in the pub.
Talking about violent exercise, says Alf. Were you at the Joe Bennett match? No, says Joe. I heard so-and-so made a cool 100 quid over it, says Alf. Who? Blazers, says Joe. And says Bloom, what I meant about tennis, for example, is the agility and training of the eye. Aye, Blazers, says Alf. He let out that Milo was on the beer to run the odds, and he's swatting all the time. We know him, says the citizen, the traitor's son. We know what put English gold in his pocket. Through fire, says Joe. And Bloom cuts in again about lawn tennis and the circulation of the blood, asking Alf, now, don't you think, Bergen? Milo does to the floor with them, says Alf. Heenan and Sayers was only a bloody fool to it. Handed him the father and mother of a beating. See the little kipper not up to his navel, and the big fella swiping. God, he gave him one last puck in the wind. Queensberry rules and all. Made him puke, but he never rest.
Good. So, talking about violent exercise, it says Alf, who said that, were you at that Keogh Bennett match? You may remember from the 10th chapter that young Dignam looked at the poster announcing this boxing match and found it was all over. So there had been something between a Keogh, an Irish name, and Bennett, an Englishman. No, said Joe. I heard so-and-so, and that's in the chapter of naming, sometimes the name is not mentioned, but you know who it is, made a cool 100 quid over it, says Alf. Who? Blazes, says Joe. Blazes Boylan. And of course, Bloom does not want to hear about Blazes Boylan right now. So he wants to change the conversation. What I meant about tennis, for example, is the agility and training of the eye. But you realize to talk at this moment when an Irishman, obviously Boylan is a kind of impresario, to talk about, of all things, tennis. Tennis is a British sport, a gentleman's sport. Like it's the wrong note, of course, training of the eye. Ah, Blazes, Alf. And they don't listen to Bloom. Alf, he let out that Myler was on the beer. He created a rumour that his champion, Myler Keogh, Irish name, was drinking to change the odds. And he's swatting all the time, and yet he was swatting training, exercising all the time. So the rumour circulated was he's in bad shape. To do something about this. True for you, said Joe. No, we know him, says the citizen, the traitor's son. We know what put English gold in his pocket, talking about Boylan and Boylan's father now. True for you, said Joe. And Bloom cut in again about lawn tennis and the circulation of the blood, asking Alf. Now, don't you think, Bergen? But okay, Bloom is not listened to. Myler dusted the floor with him. That's, of course, hyperbole, exaggeration. Says Alf, Heenan and Sayers was only a bloody footed. Heenan and Sayers was a famous boxing historical that we already heard of in chapter 10, where Stephen looked at an old print of it. So that was one of the classical games. Handed him the father and the mother of the beating. That's very Irish idioms. See the little kipper, not up to his navel, and the big fellow swiping. That must have been some time ago, but in the meantime, boxing had been regulated that you don't have a very little lightweight box against a big heavy one that has been sorted out into weights. God, he gave him one last puck. In a puck is a box. Queensbury rules and all that made him puke what he never ate. Queensbury rules. It was the Marquis of Queensbury who regulated boxing. That, for example, you must not hit under the belt and you have to have gloves and all of that. This was a regulation of it. Now, it so happens that that Queensbury, the Marquis of Queensbury, was the son, the father of Alfred Lord Douglas called Bosie, who was the friend, the boyfriend of Oscar Wilde. So Oscar Wilde is there a little bit. And he is the one who sued Oscar Wilde for homosexuality. So it would be a good name. And now we have the report of a boxing match. Again, it's a parody. And you all realize that in sports, these people who have to, in the old time, of course, you didn't see it. You had to read it the next day or had to hear it on the radio. And of course, since for practical purposes, most movements in sports are more or less the same, you have to vary a little bit in your articulation. And so this is a good example of changing phrases, of having different things. I always remember when I heard radio in football in my youth, when they said the ball, then das rum de laser, you know, a kind of elegant variation, and you get a lot of that. Incidentally, you see the two sports, boxing, you hit the others, you draw blood. In tennis, you never even touch the other, you don't get near them. So one is a very peaceful game and the other a very violent game. And so now we have a report of a boxing fight.
It was a historic and a hefty battle when Myler and Percy were scheduled to don the gloves for the purse of 50 sovereigns. Handicapped as he was by lack of poundage, Dublin's pet lamb made up for it by superlative skill in ringcraft. The final bout of fireworks was a grueling for both champions. The welterweight sergeant major had tapped some lively claret in the previous mix-up, during which Kyo had been receiver general of rights and lefts, the artilleryman putting in some neat work on the pet's nose, and Myler came on looking groggy. The soldier got to business, leading off with a powerful left jab, to which the Irish gladiator retaliated by shooting out a stiff one, flush to the point of Bennett's jaw. The redcoat ducked, but the Dubliner lifted him with a left hook, the body punch being a fine one. The men came to handy grips. Myler quickly became busy and got his man under, the bout ending with a bulkier man on the ropes, Myler punishing him. The Englishman, whose right eye was nearly closed, took his corner, where he was liberally drenched with water, and when the bell went, came on gamey and brimful of pluck, confident of knocking out the fisting of Blanite in jig time. It was a fight to the finish, and the best man for it. The two fought like tigers, and excitement ran fever high. The referee twice cautioned Pucking Percy for holding, but the pet was tricky, and his footwork a treat to watch. After a brisk exchange of courtesies, during which a smart uppercut of the military man brought blood freely from his opponent's mouth, the lamb suddenly waded in all over his man and landed a terrific left to battling Bennett's stomach, flooring him flat. It was a knockout, clean and clever. Amid tense expectation, the Portobello bruiser was being counted out when Bennett's second, Ole Potts-Wettstein, threw in the towel, and the Santry boy was declared victor to the frenzied cheers of the public, who broke through the ring ropes and fairly mobbed him with delight.
Yeah, so you see that kind of parody of a sports report where you have to change, not always the same kind of thing. And you might wonder how many people took place because the names are always changed. That is another thing, to take the boredom away, that you give them different names. It was a historic and hefty battle when Myler and Percy, Myler Q and Percy Bennett. Bennett, by the way, Joyce took the name from the Zurich British consul, who in his lawsuit against Carr did not help Joyce, was on the other side, and Joyce put his opponent there, Bennett. So, was scheduled to don the gloves, boxing gloves, for the purse of 50 sovereigns, handicapped as he was by lack of poundage. Dublin's pet lamb, I look you, made up for it by superlative skill in ring cloth. Now, lack of poundage, as I said, in the meantime, has been regulated. You can't have a very small and a very big boxer. But then it was. And of course, the little Dublin man, Pet Lamb, is winning against the great Goliath, or so things like that. The final bout of fireworks was a grueling for both champions. The welterweight sergeant major, Bennett, had tapped some lively claret, red wine, in the previous mix-up, to which Q had been receiver general of rights and lefts. The artilleryman, that's again the Englishman, putting in some neat work on the pet's nose. And Myra came on looking groggy. And you always have to think, who is who? The soldier, the Englishman, got to business, leading off with a powerful left jab, that's a technical term, to which the Irish gladiators, of course, from the Roman arena, retaliated by shooting out a stiff one flush from the point of Bennett's jaw. The red coat, that's the soldier, ducked, but the Dubliner lifted him with a left hook, and that's a boxing term, the body punch being a fine one. The man came to handy grips. Myler quickly became busy and got his man under, the bout ending with a bulkier man on the ropes, Myler punishing him. The Englishman, whose right eye was nearly closed, and you may realize in this chapter there's very often one eye only, normally they're referred to two, and that has to do with the background, the Odyssey, that the giants, the cyclopes, had only one eye. I'll come to that at some stage. His right eye was nearly closed, took his corner where he was liberally drenched with water, and when the bell went, came on gamely and brimful of pluck, confident of knocking out the fistic Eblanite. That is the Irishman. Eblana is an old word for Dublin, and the fistic Eblanite is the boxing Dubliner. In jig time, Irish dance. It was a fight to a finish and the best man for it. The two fought like tigers, and excitement ran fever high. The referee twice cautioned Perking Percy, Puck is a box, a blow, for holding, but the pet was tricky, and his footwork a treat to watch. After a quick, brisk exchange of courtesies, during which a smart uppercut of the military man brought blood freely from his opponent's mouth, the lamb certainly waded in all over his man and landed a terrific left to battling Bennett's stomach. That would not be allowed now. I think stomach is out of bounds. Flooring him flat. It was a knockout clean and clever. Amid tense expectation, the Portobello bruiser, because the barracks, the military barracks, were in Portobello, was being counted out, while Bennett's second, Old Fort's Wettstein, Wettstein is a Zurich name. That is the name of the Zurich lawyer who defended Carr against Joyce. And Joyce, of course, put the opposite lawyer in the book. I remember years ago, must have been in the 60s, 70s, when I first read this, I wrote a letter to, that I could find a lawyer, Wettstein, who of course responded, I have lost the letter. This was so insignificant for him that he's forgotten it completely. But anyway, Joyce put the lawyer here, a Zurich lawyer, on record. threw in the towel, and the Santry boy was declared victor to frenzied cheers of the public, who broke through the ring ropes and fairly mobbed him with delight. So this is the kind of typical sports report, full of changes and variations, when it's always the same thing. And of course, Joyce has great fun with names. This is a chapter where names become important. Good.
He knows which side his bread is buttered, says Al. Well, here he's running a concert tour now up in the north. He is, says Joe, isn't he? Who, says Bloom? Oh, yes, that's quite true. Yes, a kind of summer tour, you see, just a holiday. Mrs. B is the bright particular star, isn't she? Says Joe. My wife, says Bloom. She's singing, yes. I think it'd be a success, too. He's an excellent man to organise. Excellent. Oh, big gob, says I to myself, says I. That explains the milk and the coconut, an absence of hair on the animal's chest. Blazes doing the tootle on the flute. Concert tour. Dirty Dan, the Dodger's son off Island Bridge, that sold the same horses twice over to the government to fight the Boers. Oh, what? I called about the poor and water rate, Mr. Barlin. You what? The water rate, Mr. Barlin. You what? That's the buckle that'll organise or take my tip twixt me and you, Catherish. Pride of Calpe's Rocky Mount, the raven-haired daughter of Tweedy. There grew she to peerless beauty, where loquat and almond scent the air. The gardens of Alameda knew her step. The gods of olives knew and bowed. The chaste spouse of Leopold is she, Marian of the bountiful bosoms.
So, obviously, don't forget these interpolations wouldn't take up any time. They're just extension where the action is stopped and we do this. So a conversation will really go on. He knows which side his bread is buttered, says Alf. That's an old in English, you know, which side his bread is buttered on. I hear he's running a concert tour up in the north. He is, says Joe. Isn't he? Now the topic that Bloom wants to avoid comes up. Bloom pretends not to quite follow. That's quite true. Yes, a kind of summer tour, you see. Just a holiday. He's playing it down. Mrs. B is the bright particular star, isn't she? Mrs. Bloom, says Joe. My wife, she's singing, yes. I think it will be a success too. He's an excellent man to organize, excellent. So he has to say something. And they probably, I never quite know in this book how the others feel. Many seem to know about the concert tour. Do they suspect something? I don't know. But as somebody explained to me once, it was very, very unusual that any man organized a tour of an artist woman when they weren't married. So the mere fact that somebody else, not the husband, is it, was already ground for suspicion. My wife, you know, be off, says I to myself, says I. That explains the milk in the coconut and the absence of hair on the animal's chest. They're all obviously Irish idioms. Blaze is doing the tootle on the flute, concert tour. Dirty Dan, the daughter's son of Island Bridge, that is Blaze's Bavarian's father, Dirty Dan, the citizen mentioned him, of Island Bridge, that sold the same horses twice over to the government to fight the Boers. Of course, he was obviously dealing in horses, and whenever there's a war, it's a good opportunity to cheat. Whether he did sell the horses twice, we don't know. But we know the kind of political trick. Old what? Somebody comes for debt. I called about the poor and water rate, Mr. Boyle. You what? The water rate, Mr. Boyle. You what? So we try to avoid paying well. That's the buckle. That'll organise and take my tip. Twixt me and you, Calderese. Must be an Irish expression. And then, while the subject is on Molly Bloom, we have a kind of praise of her in the style, I think, of epics and things like that. Pride of Calpe's Rocky Mount. Gibraltar was called by the Semite Calpe. That's where she's from. Rocky Mount, the Rock of Gibraltar. The raven-haired daughter of Tweedy. You know, she's right. There grew she to peerless beauty, where loquat and almond scent the air. Gibraltar. The Garns of Alameda knew her step. The Garth of Olives knew and bowed. The chaste spouse of Leopoldisi. Chaste is a word we wouldn't use here, but because Leopoldisi. Marion of the bountiful bosoms. And then back to the pub.
And lo, there entered one of the clan of the O'Molloys, a comely hero, white face, yet withal somewhat ruddy, his majesty's counsel, learned in the law, and with him the prince and heir of the noble line of Lambert. Hello, Ned. Hello, Wealth. Hello, Jack. Hello, Joe. God save you, says the citizen. Save you kindly, says JJ. What'll it be, Ned? Half one, says Ned. So JJ ordered the drinks. Were you round to the court? Says Joe. Yes, says JJ. He's squared that, Ned, says he. Hope so, says Ned. Now, what were those two at? JJ getting them off the grand jury list, and the other giving the leg over the stile, with his name in Stubbs. Playing cards, hobnobbing with flash tops, with a swank glass in their eye, drinking fizz, and he half smothered in writs and garnish he orders. Pong and his girl watching Cummins of Francis Street, where no one would know him, in the private office, when I was there with Pisser, releasing his boots out of the pop. What's your name, sir? Dunn, says he. Aye, and Dunn, says I. Gob, he'll come home by Weeping Cross one of these days, I'm thinking.
No. There's a new entrance coming. And again, it's in the form of a heroic parody. A little bit like, yeah. And lo, there entered one of the clan of the O'Molloys, a comely hero of white face, yet withal somewhat ruddy. His majesty's counsel learned in the law, and with him the prince and heir of the noble line of Lambert. So here in come the two that we have seen in the 10th chapter. Remember, O'Molloy, a lawyer that Bloom noticed, he wasn't looking very healthy. He had some rod and obviously on bad times. And whereas he's come to raise some money, he doesn't get it from the editor. But later he goes to Lambert and they probably arrange. And now they come and instantly, the man who borrowed money from the other one has to buy a drink to the man who gave him the money. That's the kind of rule. And Lambert, so we saw the noble line of Lambert. Then there's the hello, 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 and things like that. Lord save you, says the citizen, says you kindly, says the joy. What'll it be, Ned? So you see, he instantly, with the money or borrowed, has to stand a drink. What'll it be, Ned? Half one, says Ned. So JJ ordered the drinks. Were you round at the court, says Joe. Yes, says JJ O'Molloy. He's a lawyer. He'll square that, Ned, says he. That's something referring to whatever deal they had. We don't know. Hope so, says Ned. Now, what are they doing? Now, what were those two at, JJ? Getting him off the grand jury list, when you have to serve on a grand jury, that's quite bothersome and takes away a lot of your time. And maybe a lawyer could, he as a lawyer, could get Lambert, who's obviously well off the list, and in return he gets a loan. And the other gave him a leg over the stile. With his name in Stubbs. Stubbs was the paper where the debtors were listed. If you couldn't pay your bills, your name appeared in Stubbs. And now the citizen knows about his background, playing cards, hobnobbing with flash tops, with a swank glass in their eye, a monocle, drinking fizz, champagne, And he, half smothered in rich and garnished orders, only bills and threats and things like that, pawning his gold watch in Cummins of Francis Street. So he once saw him pawning a gold watch in a pawner shop in Cummins Street, where no one would know him. Obviously, you would go to a place in the suburbs, know him in the private office, when I was there with Pissel, releasing his boots out of the pop, as Pissel was, he was pawning his boots, and Malloy was pawning his gold watch. And then, what's your name, sir? You have to give your name, but of course, you don't give your right name, normally. Dunn, says he. Dunn is one of the most common names in Ireland. Dunn, says I, making a little joke on Dunn and his Dunn. Gob, he'll come home by Weeping Cross one of these days, I'm thinking. So it will have a bad end of it. And you see, that they know something, usually something disadvantageous about everybody. And now, another bit of dialogue.
Did you see that bloody lunatic brain round there, says Alf? UP, up. Yes, says JJ, looking for a private detective. Aye, says Ned, and he wanted Roy Go Ron to address the court, only Corny Kelleher got round him, telling them to get the handwriting examined first. £10,000, says Alf, laughing. God, I'd give anything to hear him before a judge and jury. Was it you did it, Alf? Says Joe. The truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help you, Jimmy Johnson. Me, said Alf, don't cast your aspersions on my character. Whatever statement you make, says Joe, will be taken down in evidence against you. Of course, an action would lie, says JJ. It implies that he is not compos mentis, UP, up. Comp is your eye, says Alf, laughing. Do you know that he's balmy? Look at his head. Do you know that some mornings he has to get his hat on with a shoehorn? Yes, says JJ, but the truth of a libel is no defence to an indictment for publishing it in the eyes of the law. Ha ha, Alf, says Joe. Still, says Bloom, on account of the poor woman, I mean his wife. Pity about her, says the citizen, or any other woman marries a half and half. How half and half, says Bloom? Do you mean he half and half, I mean, says the citizen. A fellow that's neither fish nor flesh, nor good red herring, says Joe. That's what I mean, says the citizen. A pisho, if you know what that is.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Did you see the bloody lunatic Breen round here? You know, Breen is walking around outside, says Alf. UP up, the postcard. Yes, said JJ, looking for a private detective. Aye, says Ned. And he wanted right go wrong to address the court. Only Corny Keller got round him, telling him to get the handwriting examined first. Well, if it's just a UP up, and you want to sue for £10,000, you better find out who wrote it. Hmm? So that's it. £10,000, says Alf, laughing. Now, when Mrs. Breen told Bloom about that, Bloom immediately thought maybe it was Alf Bergen who did it. So he's one of the possible suspects. That's a kind of a low form of the detective novel. Who wrote that postcard? And chances are it could have been who's making something out of it for entertainment. God, I'd give anything to hear him before a judge and jury. Then they say, what did you did it, Alf? Says Joe. And then they go into the motions of the court. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That is what you have to say as a witness. So help you, Jimmy Johnson. For God, Jimmy Johnson is a whiskey. So you see. So they play actors. Me, says Alf, don't cast your nasturtiums on my character. Don't cast your nasturtiums. Your aspersions. Aspersions, nasturtiums, you know. These are the kind of little jokes they engage in on my character. Aspersions would be suspicions, things like that. And then they go through, you know, that you always hear in in murder stories. When whatever statement you make, says Joe, will be taken down in evidence against you. Play acting court. Of course, an action would lie, says JJ. He's the lawyer. An action would lie, what probably means it, you could have an action. You could complain about that. That seems, it implies that he is not compos mentis. Compos mentis is when you're of the right mind, when you're not compos, when your mind isn't put together, you're non-compos mentis. So one implication is that he's mad. You pee up. Compass your eye, says Alf, laughing. Do you know that he's balmy? Look at his head. Do you know that some mornings he has to get his hat on with a shoehorn? Yes, says JJ, but the truth of a libel is no defense to an indictment for publishing it in the eyes of the law. And here he gives his expert opinion, and I didn't know that even if something is true, what you say, you're still not allowed to publish it in the law. Ah, says he. Still, says Bloom, on account of the poor woman. I mean his wife. He knows Mrs. Breen. Pity about her, says, or any other woman that marries a half and half. We learned that Breen, or was from Italy, his name was Brini, and he changed the name to Breen, just as Bloom's father is from Hungary. How half and half, says Bloom? Do you mean he? Half and half, I mean, says the citizen, a fellow that's neither fish nor flesh. No good red herring. That's a phrase. He's neither fish nor flesh, no good red herring. That's what I mean, says the citizen. A pishogue. A pishogue is a, I don't quite know what it means. It's not a compliment. It's something bad. An Irish word. You know what that is. No, that's not probably right.
A pishogue is an old wives' tale, Fritz.
Yeah, something like that.
Old wives' tale.
Yeah.
Pishogue.
Good.
Yeah.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. But you see, it doesn't quite make sense here. That's what
no.
I mean. It's Joyce must have understood differently.
Maybe.
We know the Irish word. You're, thanks for telling.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, now, you hear something now.
The gobbler saw there was trouble coming, and Bloom explained he meant on account of her being cruel to the wife, having to ground after the old stuttered and fooled. Cruelty to animals, so it is, to let that bloody poverty-stricken brain out on grass with his beard out, tripping him, bringing down the rain. And she with her nose cock-a-hoop after she married him because a cousin of his old fellas was pew-opener to the Pope. Picture of him on the wall with the smash-all Sweeney's moustaches. The Signor Brini from Summer Hill, the Italiano, papal zouave to the Holy Father, has left the key and gone to Moss Street. And who was he, tell us? A nobody. 2 pair back-end passengers at 7 shillings a week, and he covered with all kinds of breastplates, bidding defiance to the world. And moreover, says JJ, a postcard is publication. It was held to be sufficient evidence of malice in the test case Sadgrove versus Hull. In my opinion, an action might lie. 6 and 8pence, please. Who wants your opinion? Let us drink our pints in peace. God, we won't be let even do that much itself. Well, good health, Jack, says Ned. Good health now, says JJ. There he is again, says Joe. Where? Says Al. And begob, there he was, passing the door with his boots under his oxter and the wife beside him, and Corny Keller with his wall eye looking in as they went past, talking to him like a father, trying to sell him a second-hand coffin.
Begob, I saw there was trouble coming. And Bloom explained he meant on account of it being cruel for the wife, having to go round after the old stuttering fool. Cruelty, animals, so it is. and let the bloody poverty green out on grass with his head out, tripping him, bringing down the rain. So they don't think much of Green either. He's also a foreigner. And she, with her nose cock a hoop, after she married him, because a cousin of his old fellow was a pew opener to the Pope, obviously had a job in the Vatican. Picture of him on that wall with his smash old Sweeney's moustaches, an Italian with a moustache. The Signor Brini from Summerhill. Summerhill is rather slummy. The Italiano. Italiano, you see what happened, is an Italiano, and he spells it, he pronounces it as an Englishman would spell Italiano. Italiano. And you can see that it has a tall I in it, a tall I. And perhaps here, I stop a moment and talk about something that one has to say sooner or later, and I never quite know when. When there's a student group, there's a chapter, then of course you say it. This is the Homeric background, which in this chapter makes good sense. The Homeric analogies do not always work very well, but here they do. And I suppose you all know, or have heard, have all forgotten, what happens in the Odyssey. It is book number 9. It's the most extended adventure. Odysseus and 12 men go to the Isle of the Giants. The giants are big people, separate. They don't have any social life, and they have one big round eye on their forehead, only one eye. And so they go, and go into a cave where one of them lives. It's open, and there are lots of cheeses, and they want to steal them. And Odysseus, against better counsel, stays. Then the giant comes back. He puts a big stone in front of the cave, so they're all trapped, and he milks his sheep, things like that. And then he says to them, "Who are you?" And then Odysseus, very clever, says, first, "We are men from Troy who destroyed the city." But then he realizes that he is helpless against the big force. And he says, "We are foreigners, Xenoi, Xenos." That in Greek can mean a guest or a foreigner. And of course, Odysseus harps on the guesting, and the guests must be treated well, and you should give it a gift and all of that, things like that. Then the giant says, "We don't care for the gods. You're a foreigner," Xenos, same word, and he dashes two to the ground and eats them. He's a cannibal. Then he falls asleep. In the morning, he eats two more and goes out, leaving them trapped. So their figures dwindle. They find in the cave a long pole of olive wood and sharpen it. And when the giant comes back, Odysseus has brought from an earlier adventure some very, very strong wine. And he gives them to drink. "You're mad, but look here, we brought some wine, you don't know this." And he's very grateful and drinks it and likes it. And then he falls. No, and then he says, "What is your name? And I give you a guest gift." And Odysseus very cleverly says, "My name is Utis. U is nobody. Tis is somebody. It is a bit like Odysseus, but not quite. Utis means not anyone." And he even gives him the nominative and the accusative, Utin, to make him, right? And such one, and the giant says, "My gift is I will eat you last." And then he falls asleep. Now they have prepared this pole and they put in the fire and they can come together, take out his one eye. He can't see anymore. That wouldn't work with two eyes. And then he shouts and cries, and Sorad and the other giants come and say, bad-tempered, why do you wake us in the middle of the night? Surely there's nobody who wants to kill you or who wants to take your cattle. And he says, Utis is trying to kill me by tricks. And they say, well, if nobody is there, then you better pray, and they go home. So the name Utis, no man, helps him to escape, and the giant is dead. But they're still trapped. And in the morning, they tie themselves under the sheep. Odysseus ties himself under a ram, and the giant, blind, touches their backs and doesn't realize that they're underneath, and they go to their ships. And then Odysseus calls back, you teach your lesson about hospitality. And then Odysseus stupidly says, I am Odysseus from there, and should you teach your lesson? And the giant throws him a rock at him and misses, and then they're gone. But the disadvantage is, because Odysseus said who he was, the giant, whose name is Polyphemus, can now pray to his father, Poseidon, the ruler of the sea. And so Odysseus, for the rest of his journey, has Poseidon, as his enemy. And that's it. So it was a very, very long story, I'm sorry. But this is taken over in many ways. One is lots of drinks. There are rounds of drinks, of course. And as I said, there's even a way of looking at how can you order a drink without ever naming it, and always have a different name. So then there's the one eye. And you see how often it says, well, that's I tall Yano is a tall eye. That's why that makes me introduce this background thing now. But of course, it's also when you only have one eye, you don't see stereoscopically. You have a narrow view. And narrow is, of course, nationalists only know one thing. The English are bad, the others are bad. Betting people only think about betting, and so on and so on. So it is also narrow-mindedness. But Bloom always said, but on the other side, but then and then. Then you have a lot of sheep and all of that, and you have the play on names. Odysseus saved himself by giving a wrong, misleading name, a name that looks like nobody, by the way. When you translate this, this looks very, very clumsy, a bit artificial. But in Greek, this is very, very subtle and very, very clever, and much more much more nuances than here. And so you have that names. So this is the kind of background, and we now know more. So going back to Aitoliano. And the one eye. People, father has left, he has left the key and gone to Mostri. This is like the movement of some aristocrat. Slums. And who? What he tell us? And nobody. Two pair back and patches at 7 shillings to eat. And covered all kind of breastplates, bidding the fountain. Breastplates have to do something with religion. And moreover, says J.J., a postcard is publication. If you write the postcard, this is public. And then he gives some law technicalities. It was held to be sufficient evidence of malice in the test case Sadro versus Hole. In my opinion, an action might lie. The comment, 6 and 8 pence, please. 6 and 8 pence was the fee of a lawyer. And he means, same old thing, we don't want to hear it. Who wants your opinion? Let us drink our pints in peace. Oh, we won't be let even do that much itself. Well, good health, Jack, says Ned. Good health. There he is again, the were-alf. And begob, there he was passing the door with his books under his oxter, his armpit, and the wife beside him, and Connie Keller with wall eye. Connie Keller has a squint, looking in as they went past, talking to them like a father, trying to sell them a second-hand coffin. Before you go on, some other little piece, and that's a strange coincidence that Joyce couldn't do anything about it. In, well, that will come later, but I say it anyway now. It will turn out that that Lenehan says the race wasn't going as he wanted. The outsider throwaway won. That's a race that nobody was counting on. If you're betting now on Luxembourg, they will win the championship. That's the same an outsider. 20-1 to come. Now, that was true of the horse. It's a real race that took place this day. And the odds were 20-1. When Odysseus brought his very strong wine, in Greek, wine had to be diluted. It had to be diluted at the rate of, you guess it, 20-1. That's in the Odyssey. So one thing is a historical minor fact, and the other, and it comes together. I don't even know if Joyce knew it, but if he did, he would have been quite happy. We're only doing the next paragraph, but then we have to stop. So only £2.
How did the Canada Swindle case go off, says Joe? Remanded, says JJ. One of the bottlenose fraternity it was, went by the name of James Watt, alias Shapiro, alias Spark and Spiro, put an ad in the papers saying he'd give a passage to Canada for 20 bob. What? Do you see any green in the white of my eye? Of course it was a bloody barney, what? Swindled them all, skivvies and buttocks from the county mead. Aye, and his own kidney too. JJ was telling us there was an ancient Hebrew, Zaretsky or something, weeping in the witness box with his hat on him, swearing by the holy Moses he was stuck for £2.
Stop now. Yeah. Then, because the lawyer is there, they say, how did that Canada swindle case go off? There were always lots of cases in court, and the lawyer would know. Remanded, postponed. And then the narrator knows one of the bottlenose fraternity Jews. It was, went by the name of James Ward, alias Sapphire, alias Spark and Spiro, and there were, in fact, on that day, 16th of June, there were, in fact, cases, as you know, there were passages to America or Canada, cheap, and of course, there was a lot of swindle. And one of these cases came up. Of course, it didn't happen. What? And these names are in the paper. They're all pseudonyms, wrong names. Paper saying it gave a passage to Canada for 20 bob, for £1. Do you see any green in the white of my eye? Of course it was a bloody barney. What? Swindle them all. Stevis and Badax, these servants and rustic people from the county Meath, provincials, Meath eye, and his own kidney too. His own Jewish compatriots. JJ was telling us there was an ancient Hebrew, Zaretsky, or something, weeping in the witness box with his hat on, swearing by the holy Moses he was stuck for £2. And so they talk a little bit about that, but I have to stop here. And the reason is, really, I am on an international Zoom with the James Joyce Society, because next week, by the way, is Bloomsday, and there is a symposium in Trieste the whole week, but nobody's going there. And now we have to talk about a few things. So I leave it. But I think we've had enough, and I also hope you're enjoying it then. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.